Hi, everyone. Welcome back to News and Brews Sports Biz, a podcast where we delve into the financial intricacies of college athletics. I'm Shane Metzler.
And I'm Brendan McKittrick.
And I'm Ken Kurdzel. In previous episodes of this podcast, we've spent time talking about the tax impacts of NIL to the student athletes themselves. Today, we're going to switch a little bit and talk about NIL and taxes, but shift the focus to look at it from the perspective of an NIL collective. We're excited to have Aaron Spivak, one of our James Moore tax partners, join us as we navigate this timely subject. Welcome, Aaron.
To get things started, Aaron, could we talk about the income and expense for NIL collectives, specifically when funds are held on behalf of others? You know, how does that affect their tax obligations? And also, you know, would the situation differ between a standalone collective versus a collective, say, managed by a third party?
Well, thanks for having me, guys. That's kind of a loaded question to ask in the beginning, and you'll hear me say this a lot, but it really depends. So if you think about an NIL collective on its own, which could be set up in a couple of different ways, exempt, for profit, you really have to look at what is their obligation in return for the income they're receiving. So for example, if they're getting a pledge or a contribution, and that is their money to keep regardless of how it's used or how it has to be used or when it has to be used, it's income. If we have to delve into more of a contract type basis, where if the money they receive can only be used for certain sports or for a certain promotional or advertising purpose, and if it's not used in that way, it has to be given back to the person who gave it or the business that gave it, it may not be income at that point. It could be more like a restricted type asset. Completely shifting to if you're actually managing NIL collectives and you're collecting money from them and then doing all of the accounting and management work, really you're holding that money, I want to use a very loose term here, in trust for the people to spend the money for the promotion of NIL athletes. So it's not really your income. Your income is only the portion that you're getting to actually manage that whole relationship and account. So you really have to go back to what was the intention of the income that's coming in. You get to keep it no matter what. And then really it goes down to the legal and contractual part of between you and the party who gave it to you. So again, a bit complicated, and it has to be looked on a situation by situation basis.
And Aaron, just to expand on that a little bit, you know, a lot of the NIL collectives have these monthly membership amounts that fans are choosing to become members of the collective and paying $100, $200, $300 per month to be members. My understanding would be that that type of arrangement, that income is likely, that is likely income immediately. Would you agree?
I would agree. Yeah, because you're receiving it without any having to give it back or provide services. They're just a member of your, it's like a subscription almost.
Right.
A subscription-based business. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. And just to clarify, one other matter is, you know, and we're going to talk a little bit about nonprofits in this episode also, but for-profit NIL collectives can still receive contributions. I mean, a contribution can, you know, is not limited to just nonprofits. It can also go to a for-profit, correct?
Yeah, it's just income at that point. We use the word contribution, and you hear that in the nonprofit segment because that is a deductible contribution as a charity, but you can receive contributions. It's just income and what you're using the income to then do in your for-profit business.
All right.
Great. Well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for giving a little bit of clarity on that, Aaron, although it does sound like in most cases, it really just depends. So, Ken, I actually want to draw on your expertise for a minute. So there have been some recent changes that we've seen that are impacting tax-exempt NIL collectives, specifically regarding the tax deductibility of contributions going to those collectives. Could you shed some light on what those changes have been?
I would be happy to. And yes, this is an area that has very recently just kind of really, it's going to shake the NIL collective world. It's something that we've talked about a lot on News and Brews in past episodes. I remember one that Katie and I did over a year ago, I think, interviewing Matt Brown, and we were talking about NIL collectives and those that were choosing to follow the 501c3 tax exempt status. And, you know, quite frankly, I know Katie and my and Matt Brown's opinion on that was that it was potentially a dangerous road to go down, that it could easily get challenged by the IRS upon audit, and that it seemed to have some really shaky legal ground. And indeed, we've just seen a recent memo from the IRS that is questioning that. There have been some recent hearings, and in that, the House Committee on Energy and Commerce noted that there's over 250 NIL collectives, approximately, with about a third of those organized as nonprofits. This IRS memo that was issued recently questions whether these collectives truly are furthering an exempt purpose under Section 501c3, which is the section of the code that grants them charitable status and tax exempt status. So what the IRS is essentially saying is that an organization can't qualify for tax exemption if it's primarily operated for private interests rather than public ones. They would argue that the benefits NIL collectives provide to student athletes, they aren't incidental to the exemptions, the organization's exempt purpose, which is required for maintaining that 501c3 status. So we've said that basically this is kind of a shot across the bow coming from the IRS. Now, you know, it's not certain exactly how this will proceed because unfortunately the IRS has also approved many, many, many 501c3 exemptions for these types of entities. And now is a little bit kind of going back on that and questioning it. In their defense, this is a very new and emerging area. So, you know, I think that quite frankly, the public scrutiny of these NIL collectives and the thought of, you know, $1 million type contributions that have tax deductions associated with them, for what is essentially, you know, paying student athletes to play for a particular school, that just didn't smell right, which it doesn't. And, you know, is therefore now questioning the 501c3 status. So I think that if you are a 501c3 collective, you're going to need to pause and check with attorneys and accountants and others to figure out what to do next, whether to continue to receive contributions into it, at the very least, you know, probably not receiving them as tax deductible contributions, but, you know, even what happens with those 501c3s, do they eventually wind down and, you know, come into some new structure as a for-profit entity or at least a nonprofit, some other type of nonprofit entity? There are other types other than 501c3s as well that don't grant charitable deductions. So there's numerous possible avenues, and this memo is very new, and there's, you know, it still is yet to be determined exactly what the next steps look like on it, but it's fast. It's a murky area. The other thing to note also is there's some bipartisan legislation out there from Senators Cardin and Thune that have put out legislation that would basically disallow charitable contributions to NIL collectives. So that would also effectively end the idea of 501c3 collectives. So between the legislation and this IRS memo, I would say that tread carefully if you are a tax-exempt NIL collective.
Thanks, Ken. And as you were discussing that, it actually, you know, brought another question to my mind. And Aaron, maybe you can, you know, give a quick response on this. But if a NIL collective loses the 501c3 designation, does that call into question charitable contributions on like an individual income tax return that was previously filed? Would you have to go back and look at those, or is that kind of outside of the statute of limitations?
That's a good question, Shane. It's not outside the statute, and it would really be, this is a tricky one because technically they were a 501c3 when you donated or contributed to it and you were lawful in taking that deduction. If the IRS went back and determined that they were really a 501c3 in that year, I don't know how they would handle potentially the hundreds to thousands of the contributions that people deducted in best faith that it was a 501c3 and deductible. So that is a really good and interesting question. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and it's actually one that I've spent some time talking to our nonprofit tax team here at the firm on, and the likely answer is that it is not likely to impact a donor. When our nonprofit, senior nonprofit tax manager, who's got many, many years of experience in this area and is deeply in this space, as she indicated to me that if a donor, you know, you could look these up, and the these 501c3 collectives are currently granted 501c3 status. So if they in good faith are making a contribution to a 501c3, and especially if it was last year and maybe even up to this point this year before this memo, she didn't think there was much risk there that they don't go back and challenge it, that this is a more forward-looking, where do we go from here type of situation.
Well, and that's really good news, because if anybody's been dealing with the IRS in the past few years, they have a lot on their plate. So this would be a big one for them to try and take on to disallow a bunch of deductions. So that's good to hear.
Right. So switching gears a bit, Aaron, going back to the for-profit side and taxation, could you shed a little light on state and local tax discovery? Should that be a focus, or should the focus be on the location of the NIL collective, where the revenue is generated, or where the funds are expended? What does that look like?
Yeah, so it really depends. And that is, again, not meant to be the theme of this, but every state has different rules. And it really, they look at from an income tax perspective, and even a sales tax perspective, if that ever came into play. They look at different ways of what they call nexus, which is where they determine if you're required, whether you're located in the state, which at that point you would always be required to file in that state tax return, or if you're getting revenue or paying other people for performing services in a different state, or the revenue is coming from a different state. Each state has different rules. So I bet in my mind, they haven't even begun to discover from the NIL side what this would look like. So we would have to look back at the normal revenue allocation rules, payroll allocation rules, vendor payment allocation rules to determine what states particularly you might have to file in. So if you're a third party who's doing these services on behalf of other NIL collectives, there's a potential that because you have customers in multiple states, that your entity may need to file tax returns, income tax returns in multiple states because of that. So it could get quite complicated quite fast.
Yeah, definitely sounds like there's a lot of things to kind of think through on that. I guess to kind of add on to that, or kind of, you know, looking at it from the athlete's perspective, you know, as they're kind of, the athletes themselves are moving around, how critical is it for them to, you know, have the correct address on their W-9? And I guess, Aaron, you know, any suggestions on best practices?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, because, you know, as the person who's receiving the payments, you're going to get a 1099 from the NIL collective telling you how much they paid you for your services during the year. If they have the incorrect address, because as you noted, they move, that athletes can move around a lot, you may not get that 1099 and may inadvertently not report enough income on your tax return. What's going to happen then is the IRS is going to send you a notice or a letter in a couple of years that says, hey, you forgot to report this $10,000 of income. If this is correct and you didn't report it like you should have, here's the tax, interest, and penalties that could quickly add up. So you want to make sure that you have any collective that they were paid by, that they have a corrected W-9 on file by the end of the year, December 31st. So that collective can issue the 1099 to whatever address is accurate for those. And then because they're also sending those same 1099s to the IRS on your behalf, and the IRS uses that by matching Social Security numbers. So I would actually say on the NLI side, also to prevent yourself from getting notices that you have mismatching of names or addresses or Social Security numbers, that you make sure by the end of the year that you have all updated and accurate W-9s on file, so that you can issue those 1099s correctly.
Very important questions brought up there indeed. Before we wrap up, Aaron, are there any other key points or advice that you think our listeners should know about income taxes and NIL collectives?
I think that what you talked about earlier, Ken, that the IRS is now just catching up with this new industry and this new emerging source of revenue for the IRS from a tax perspective, that there's going to be a lot more information and guidance coming out from them in the next 2 to 3 years. And it's really important for them, for NIL collectives, to stay on top of what the IRS is saying, how it has to be reported as income, what deductions you have to make, what reporting requirements are there. Because again, you'll want to be in compliance with the IRS to make sure that you're not getting audited or getting back taxes assessed to you that you weren't even aware of.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of moving parts and a lot of things to think about. So really appreciate all those insights, Aaron. So now to, as our tradition, we get to talk about our favorite brews. So Aaron, as our guest today, we'll start with you. If you want to share with your brew of choice.
Oh, yes. Mine's a summer special, which is First Magnitude Brewery's Honeybee Citrus Ale is my favorite right now.
I haven't tried that one yet, but I will definitely have to with it being right here in town. Brendan, what's your brew of choice right now?
I'm going to go with one I had last night. It's Gunner's Daughter by Mass Landing up in the Northeast. A little bit of a change of pace for me. I've been drinking lighter beers recently, but this one's more of kind of a stout, peanut butter coffee, dark chocolate type flavors. So really enjoyed that one last night.
That's great. And myself, I've currently, I've highlighted beer quite a bit recently, but had a good glass of wine last night when we're actually out with a collegiate athletics client. And we shared some Faust Cabernet Sauvignons from 2018 Napa Valley Cab. It was excellent with a great steak. So really enjoyed that. And Shane, how about you? What are you enjoying?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest. Normally when I'm on here, I also would choose a beer, but I have a 3-week-old at home. And so my current brew of choice is coffee, and I'm a cold brew fanatic. And so when I am at home, my cold brew of choice is Stoke cold brew, which is delicious and refreshing. So
outstanding with lots of caffeine to keep you awake, right?
That's right, and very necessary.
Yes. Well, congratulations on child number two, Shane. So.
Thank you.
Aaron, we can't thank you enough for joining us today and sharing your expert insights. We've definitely learned a lot.
Couldn't agree more, Ken. And a big thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of News & Brew Sports Biz. Stay with us for next month as we bring more insights to the world of college athletics finance. Until then, cheers.
Cheers.
To learn more about the James Moore & Company Collegiate Athletics and Higher Education segments, go to jmco.com. And don't forget to sign up for Insights to get our latest industry updates, news, and events delivered straight to your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at JMCO Higher Ed and on LinkedIn for the latest news as the landscape of collegiate athletics and higher education is continually evolving.